During those years, and the feverish years of unsettlement that followed, things occurred in India, the massacre of an unarmed crowd at Amritsar, in which nearly 2,000 people were killed or wounded, floggings and humiliating outrages, a sort of official's terror that produced a profound moral shock when at last the Hunter Commission of 1919 brought them before the home public. In liberal-minded Englishmen, who have been wont to regard their empire as an incipient league of free peoples, this revelation of the barbaric quality in its administrators produced a very understandable dismay. But the time hasn't yet come for writing the chapter of history that India is opening for herself. We can't discuss here in detail the still unsettled problems of the new India that struggles into being. Already in the Government of India Act of 1919, we may have the opening of a new and happier era that may culminate in a free and willing group of Indian peoples taking an equal place among the confederated states of the world. The growth of the British Empire in directions other than that of India was by no means so rapid during the earlier half of the 19th century. A considerable school of political thinkers in Britain was disposed to regard overseas possessions as a source of weakness to the kingdom. The Australian settlements developed slowly until in 1842 the discovery of valuable copper mines, and in 1851 of gold, gave them a new importance. Improvements in transport were also making Australian wool an increasingly marketable commodity in Europe. Canada, too, wasn't remarkably progressive until 1849. It was troubled by dissensions between its French and British inhabitants. There were several serious revolts, and it was only in 1867 that a new constitution creating a federal dominion of Canada relieved its internal strains. It was the railway that altered the Canadian outlook. It enabled Canada, just as it enabled the United States, to expand westward, to market its corn and other produce in Europe, and in spite of its swift and extensive growth, to remain in language and sympathy and interests one community. The railway, the steamship, and the telegraphic cable were indeed changing all the conditions of colonial development. Before 1840, English settlements had already begun in New Zealand, and a New Zealand land company had been formed to exploit the possibilities of the island. In 1840, New Zealand also was added to the colonial possessions of the British Crown. Canada, as we've noted, was the first of the British possessions to respond richly to the new economic possibilities the new methods of transport were opening. Presently, the republics of South America, and particularly the Argentine Republic, began to feel, in their cattle trade and coffee growing, the increased nearness of the European market. Hitherto, the chief commodities that had attracted the European powers into unsettled and barbaric regions had been gold or other metals, spices, ivory, or slaves. But in the latter quarter of the 19th century, the increase of the European populations was obliging their governments to look abroad for staple foods, and the growth of scientific industrialism was creating a demand for new raw materials, fats and greases of every kind, rubber, and other hitherto disregarded substances. It was plain that Great Britain and Holland and Portugal were reaping a great and growing commercial advantage from their very considerable control of tropical and subtropical products. After 1871, Germany and presently France and later Italy began to look for unannexed raw material areas or for oriental countries capable of profitable modernization. So began a fresh scramble all over the world, except in the American region, where the Monroe Doctrine now barred such adventures, for politically unprotected lands. Close to Europe was the continent of Africa, full of vaguely known possibilities. In 1850 it was a continent of black mystery. Only Egypt and the coast were known. A map must show the greatness of the European ignorance at that time. It would need a book as long as this outline to do justice to the amazing story of the explorers and adventurers who first pierced this cloud of darkness, and to the political agents, administrators, traders, settlers, and scientific men who followed in their track. Wonderful races of men like the pygmies, strange beasts like the okapi, marvelous fruits and flowers and insects, terrible diseases, astounding scenery of forest and mountain, enormous inland seas and gigantic rivers and cascades were revealed. A whole new world. Even remains at Zimbabwe of some unrecorded and vanished civilizations, the southward enterprise of an early people, were discovered. Into this new world came the Europeans, and found the rifle already there in the hands of the Arab slave traders, and Negro life in disorder. By 1900, as our second map must show, all Europe was mapped, explored, estimated, and divided between the European powers, divided with much snarling and disputation into portions that left each power uneasy or discontented. Little heed was given to the welfare of the natives in this scramble. The Arab slaver was indeed curbed rather than expelled, but the greed for rubber, which was a wild product collected under compulsion by the natives in the Belgian Congo, a greed exacerbated by the pitiless avarice of the King of the Belgians and the clash of inexperienced European administrators with the native population in many other annexations, led to horrible atrocities. No European power has perfectly clean hands in this matter. We can't tell here in any detail how Great Britain got possession of Egypt in 1883 and remained there, in spite of the fact that Egypt was technically a part of the Turkish Empire, nor how nearly this scramble led to war between France and Great Britain in 1898, when a certain Colonel Marchand, crossing Central Africa from the west coast, tried at Fashoda to seize the Upper Nile. In Uganda, the French Catholic and the British Anglican missionaries disseminated a form of Christianity so heavily charged with the spirit of Napoleon and so finely insistent upon the nuances of doctrine that a few years after its first glimpse of European civilization, Mengo, the capital of Uganda, was littered with dead Protestants and Catholics, extremely difficult to distinguish from the entirely unspiritual warriors of the old regime. Nor can we tell how the British government first let the Boers or Dutch settlers of the Orange River district and the Transvaal set up independent republics in the inland parts of South Africa, and then repented and annexed the Transvaal Republic in 1877. Nor how the Transvaal Boers fought for freedom and won it after the Battle of Majuba Hill in 1881. Majuba Hill was made to rankle in the memory of the English people by a persistent press campaign. A war with both republics broke out in 1899, a 3 years' war, enormously costly to the British people, which ended at last in the surrender of the two republics. Their period of subjugation was a brief one. In 1907, after the downfall of the imperialist government which had conquered them, the liberals took the South African problem in hand, and these former republics became free and fairly willing associates with Cape Colony and Natal, in a confederation of all the states of South Africa as one self-governing republic under the British crown. In a quarter of a century, the partition of Africa was completed. There remained unannexed three comparatively small countries: Liberia, a settlement of liberated Negro slaves on the west coast, Morocco, under a Muslim sultan, and Abyssinia, a barbaric country with an ancient and peculiar form of Christianity, which had successfully maintained its independence against Italy at the Battle of Adowa in 1896.